Hybrid Cloud Show, episode 25. I'm Aaron.
I'm Gary.
I'm Sean.
And I'm Shane.
Welcome to the show about public cloud, private cloud, and everything in between. Our views here are ours and not those of our employers. So I've seen in the news recently that Docker's changed some policies. Is there someone who can give me a rundown on what those policy changes are and what they mean in practice?
So Docker have decided to further reduce the limits of how many images you can pull from their Docker Hub repository. I think they switched it to, if you are unauthenticated, it is 10 images an hour. And if you are authenticated, then it is 40 images an hour. And this is impactful because this means that anybody who's doing anything now can only pull 10 images an hour. And if you have like a Kubernetes home lab, or even just if you have a Kubernetes cluster at all, and you have 10 nodes and you deploy one new application, then you have used up your whole entire bandwidth from Docker Hub for that whole hour.
This was mentioned as a risk several years ago. They did announce that they were going to do this and rolled it back. But now they've done the like typical company strategy, it seems, which is announce unpopular decision, immediately realize, oh, everyone hates that, and then just delaying it a month. I don't really understand. Like, there's 3 years with lots of time to do something about this, but it felt like they'd roll back the decision, and now it's you get a month. Like, there's probably somewhere in the middle that's probably more reasonable time frame for people to respond, like maybe 6 months, or like start like brownouts at some point, rather than just like immediately doing this. I know we should have all done this, but you know, priorities change and this becomes less important. So yeah, the timing is kind of annoying, and I'm just a little bit, rubs me the wrong way, the way they, like, everyone now approach delivering on popular news.
Well, they could have done it just before Christmas like other repositories did. So yeah, they didn't ruin everyone's day entirely. And like you said, Shane, it's 2 or 3 years since they first announced that this was going to be a thing that might happen, then pulled it back or made it less restrictive so that it wasn't a problem. So really, it's a piece of technical debt that we should have dealt with, and now we're just all pissed off because we didn't deal with it when the warning shot was fired 2 years ago, and now it's come to bite us.
We did some. I remember a lot of people started changing their registry qualified names for their images, and that has helped a lot. It also brought attention to the fact that if you just type in like Nginx, right, as an image name, that it goes straight up to the Docker repository by default. And we did do some work around that. However, that was a lot of the bigger companies that had these extra repositories, these container registries, and it still is going to bite a lot of people who don't host their images somewhere else.
I remember being really surprised at the time that people didn't know that if you just type Nginx, it actually did docker.io/Nginx, because I just thought that was really common knowledge. But yeah, I think we saw a lot of open source projects move their stuff to the GitHub container registry as well. So there's loads of ghcr.io images or compose files or Helm charts out there by default, which I suppose mitigates this for a lot of stuff. And a lot of those projects are also dual hosting on Docker Hub and GitHub container registry and Amazon's container registry and a bunch of others. So I suppose there are ways to get around this for a bunch of the most popular containers.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask next, is in the people that you see using container registries, how many people are still using Docker Hub versus the cloud-specific registries or GitHub registries or all those sorts of different places that you can host your containers?
And for private images, like, most people aren't using Docker Hub, right? Like, if I've got my corporate build pipeline, that's going to the one that's built into OpenShift or Amazon's one or Azure's one. They're absolutely not using Docker Hub for that, because that's another bill I've got to pay and it's another thing I've got to explain to accounts. I'm just using whatever is built into the public cloud I'm using. I suppose where it becomes slightly more impactful is when you're building from a source image that only exists in Docker Hub. Then you've probably got to do a bunch of work to pull the latest image every day, keep it cached locally, and then do your builds on top of that. So it's not a huge deal. You've got to put some infrastructure in place to pull from Docker Hub, cache it locally in a registry that you own and control, and then change your builds to build on top of that. But it's not insurmountable in most cases, I would argue.
That actually was a question I was going to ask. What are you guys using for these pull-through caches? I know Harbor is out there. It hasn't impressed me. Do you guys have any other suggestions?
I'm lazy like Gary. I'm just going to use the public cloud, whatever it provides. Harbor's self-hosted, right? And I think from knowledge, that is the de facto one I'm aware of. Haven't even heard of an alternative, but probably one is due to be built, or Harbor needs to get a little better. Let's be honest. Many of us are lazy. What is the easiest way right now for someone to like mitigate this? Is there like any public clouds out there that offer like a public proxy to this that I can just point to? So I just have set a config thing somewhere that says, rather than doing docker.io pull from, I don't know, Google Cloud or something. Or is it all like you have to be a paying provider or something to swap this over?
I'm not aware of any transparent proxies, because then the impetus to pay would be on whoever's running that transparent proxy, right? So you're going to be fairly reliant on the provider of the image pushing it somewhere that isn't Docker Hub that you can pull from, or you're going to have to build some manual tooling to pull that image into a cache locally and build on top of that. I think a transparent proxy is somewhat out of the question, unless there's a company that's super friendly with Docker and is willing to pay them a ton of money. That would be great.
Great. I'm going to need a whole entire VPN just to pull down new images.
That could be a service. Just rotate IPs to pull images, right?
That's so dumb. 10 is a really low number, though. That's going to really impact a lot of people because, like Gary said, a CI/CD pipeline is a really good example of something you're going to pull the same image over and over again and probably multiple times per day. You're going to burn through it real quick. And if I was a CI/CD company like Drone or GitLab or GitHub that did this, I would be expecting some support tickets.
I do wonder what's going to happen for GitHub Actions or a GitLab runner that's hosted by them, because that's a shared IP, right?
It is.
It's just a box that gets rotated around and around. So is that going to break? I don't know. Have they done a deal with Microsoft or GitLab to work around those things and whitelist their IP space? That feels like a quite open-ended question that I've not seen an answer to yet, because that's going to break a bunch of people's stuff, even if they are hosting their own build pipelines and they are caching the images.
So, Sean, for your extensive home lab there of too many clusters for the Docker pull limits, are you working around this in some way, or what are you going to do?
I really don't know. The VPN thing was a joke. I'm actually going to do that. But I'm definitely going to have to do something, because I know for a fact that I pull more than that. I have to check to see if it's from Docker Hub, but likely what I will do then is probably have to set up my clusters to use my Docker registry credentials so they can log in. So then I can have the bumped up maximum to 40. That's probably the interim solution. I'll have to look at what standing up a pull through cache actually entails.
I will keep us posted if you end up setting something up.
I think a bunch of solutions are going to come up in this space, right, in terms of a pull through cache. You just almost need something like an apt cache that works for container images.
Yeah.
I think that is the ultimate solution. Like an apt cacher ng for Docker would be perfect. And then I just point it at whatever my local thing is, and that works.
I mean, even like the Docker registry itself, that's like the base image of like registry, that you could self-host. And I do that to do some of my bootable container stuff locally. So that could be an option too.
I think there'll probably be a bunch of stuff that pops up. So I think we'll definitely have to keep an eye and report back on what we see.
Different big things that you're likely to be using are hosted in multiple places. So your operating system images and things like that are often going to be in the official image registries for each of the clouds that you will be using. So it might be that you can point at those instead to deal with some of the things that you're building.
It's an interesting choice from Docker. I know bandwidth's expensive, but I do wonder how much data they're going to lose on their customers by doing this. Like, I guess they made the call that this is worth the trade-off. At my company, we use Scarf for like, it's kind of like Google Analytics for open source projects. And we use containers to like get some metrics about who is pulling some of our images. And that's the sort of product that you might pay for that Docker could have offered as like a nice solution. So I guess they didn't see any product opportunities in that space and just want to save money. It's an interesting decision.
This episode is sponsored by SysCloud. Companies big and small rely a lot on SaaS applications to run their business. But what happens when critical SaaS data is lost due to human errors, accidental deletions, or ransomware attacks? That's where SysCloud comes in. It's a single pane of glass to back up all critical SaaS applications such as Microsoft 365, Google Workspace, Salesforce, Slack, HubSpot, QuickBooks Online, to name a few. SysCloud also helps with ransomware recovery, identifies compliance gaps in your SaaS data, monitors for unusual data activity, and can automatically archive inactive SaaS data to save on storage costs. Plus, it's SOC 2 certified, so data remains secure in the cloud. Over 2,000 IT admins already trust SysCloud to protect their SaaS data. Head to syscloud.com for a 30-day free trial. And, for a limited time, use code HCS to get 50% off your first purchase. That's syscloud.com. So relatively recently, Canonical announced a Kubernetes LTS, long-term support, that's going to receive security maintenance for, they say, at least 12 years of committed security maintenance. We've seen a few different, much shorter extended lifetimes for Kubernetes across different cloud providers and things like that. So I thought I would talk to you about your feelings on extended Kubernetes support, where we are in terms of how much people actually need and how useful these sorts of things are in enterprise deployments.
Just speaking as an engineer, if I was at a company running Kubernetes and decided after 3 or 4 years to start paying for the long-term support, I'd be really nervous that in about 10 years' time, I would be the person left trying to get from version 1 to version 4 and have on a tight deadline and having a miserable time about it. So it feels like it's kicking the can down the road. The other thing that worries me is like Kubernetes isn't really something that runs in isolation. So fine that the distro would run for 12 years, but the whole ecosystem around it, like Kubernetes, it doesn't do much by itself. It's pulls in tons of dependencies and, you know, then they're pulling in probably dozens of Helm charts, pulling down dozens of images. Yes, your distro might stay the same, but the world around it's going to move on and you are going to probably feel a lot of pain in a couple of years.
I would also be concerned about what that says about the engineering culture and the attitude towards accumulating technical debt at said company, if I were an engineer at the company. But flip side, I completely get that there are probably some heavily regulated workloads where this does perhaps make sense. I know that banks and financial institutions, for example, are one such place that really struggle with getting approval and testing and whatever else it is to upgrade on the time frame that the CNCF generally support Kubernetes releases for. Say, there is perhaps, if I'm playing devil's advocate, some use for this, and clearly Canonical don't live in a vacuum, right? Like this has come from a customer somewhere. But I would be concerned at any company with kind of an engineering-led culture about what this would mean if someone were to implement this. I think in my experience, Kubernetes upgrades are sometimes difficult. And there are sometimes things that you have to do to move from 1.3 to 1.32 and 1.32 onwards. I'm sure there will be other changes coming down the pipeline that mean you're going to have to update things. And that stuff often, as a quote-unquote non-functional requirement, does go to the bottom of the list. And as you alluded to, Aaron, that's why cloud providers have started offering extended support, or by default, in some cases, auto-enrolling customers in extended support. Because what often used to happen was a cloud provider would end of life Kubernetes 1.28 or insert version here, and customers would kick it down the road and kick it down the road, and they would ask for an extension from the cloud provider and go with the begging bowl and say, please, sir, can I keep running 1.28 until December because I've got my peak trading period coming up? And then they would upgrade once they were forced to. Once AWS or whoever it is said, no, we're going to auto-upgrade your cluster and break stuff if you don't do it. So there is a model now where that doesn't happen and you get auto-enrolled onto the extended support. And actually, what I've seen is that the financial incentive that comes with your AWS bill suddenly spiking by $1,000 a month for extended support for not just EKS or Kubernetes, but other services as well, is often more of an incentive to get those initiatives to run upgrades prioritized than perhaps killing it or the threat of killing it may have otherwise been.
Being an engineer on the ground, like, being on a cloud provider that was like, I'm thinking specifically out of MySQL 5.7 to 8, version bump where the entire company is dependent on 5.7 and it's going to be a pile of misery to migrate up. No one's going to choose to do that. But when a cloud provider forces you to do that upgrade and sets a time frame, like, you can kind of lean on that to be like, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to do the work to upgrade. So giving people this option, it could set a dangerous engineering culture. If an executive said, well, we could spend all the money to continually upgrade, or we just pay the money to Canonical and kick the can down the road, you lose a lot of bargaining chips, I think.
It's a non-functional requirement. It's saying that these companies, Canonical, Red Hat, SUSE, Microsoft, Google, everyone has to be able to say, oh, we can support your application for this long, right? Otherwise, some companies, I'm talking enterprises, right, won't even look at you as a potential solution. So it's a non-functional requirement. I hope to God, no one is actually having a Kubernetes cluster running for 12 years, because like Shane said, cloud moves fast. And what works today, a Helm pool, whatever, and Helm install command today for Helm 3 is not going to work in a couple of years. And phasing them out is hopefully not going to be as painful as like Helm 2 to Helm 3 or Python 2 to Python 3, but enough inertia behind the cloud movement to keep everyone from lagging 12 years behind.
I even found, like, between Kubernetes 1.3.1 and 1.3.2 this week, that I had some stuff that was manually deployed. It was the AWS load balancer stuff that was manually deployed using just the YAML rather than the Helm chart that I could pull from the repository and get the latest version of whatever that deployment was. Just the stuff on AWS's docs didn't work in the latest version of EKS. Just madness. So yeah, to think what that's going to be like if I'm running Kubernetes 1.32 in 2037, I don't even want to think about it, frankly.
I won't have to. I'll be in a flying car.
I wonder how much of these extended support offerings come from a little bit of stability in the Kubernetes world compared to how it used to be. So, you know, this idea of having these kinds of lengths of security maintenance or whatever for an old Kubernetes would have been ridiculous. But now that the pace of change in Kubernetes has slowed down a bit, it's slightly more realistic that companies would be deploying an application that was containerized on a Kubernetes and leave that in production, say at an edge site of a mobile network or something, for long periods of time. And I know in some of those industries, as Gary alluded to before, the regulatory requirements and the time of testing and everything, by the time you've got a provider who has created a solution built on something, and then it's been tested and it's been signed off by a regulator, and then they're selling it to customers, by the time it gets out into production, it can be nearing the end of a shorter support lifetime. So I do wonder if some of it's motivated by the kinds of industries who've now started adopting Kubernetes being a little bit different from how they were 5 years ago.
I did wonder if maybe there's a more charitable interpretation, which is like, I'm going to run my applications on Kubernetes and have it run for a long time. If the operating system I'm running on has got 12 years of support, what services am I also running? And what are the support contracts for that? What do they look like? Maybe it's like a way to sort of start to put pressure on, like, I'm thinking of Istio or something like that, or Kiverno, or maybe pushing them a little to like offer more long-term support windows as well. Like, at least Kubernetes is supported for 12 years. Let's see what else I can like get that extended window for. Basically, what I'm saying is, like, I'm wondering if Canonical are kind of trying to change the industry a little bit to think more stable.
I think that you would probably do that through stability of APIs and ABIs, though, right? I don't think that it's the right thing to do to advocate keeping the same version around for so long. So I get what you're saying in that we want to encourage that longer-term thinking in terms of these deployments. However, I just can't see it being particularly pleasant to be on the receiving end of a guy that left three jobs ago, this cluster that they built, having to pick that up when it falls over. I mean, I've had to do that with like 3 or 4 year old clusters before, and that's painful enough. And I can't imagine tripling or quadrupling that time frame of technical debt.
I've seen a good number of customers who take a very application-centric view to the way that they deploy their infrastructure. And once they have built a stack and put it into production, they very much seem to leave it as it was until they're ready to migrate that to a very different way of doing things. And so I've seen people coming off extremely old operating systems where the next step for them from a very old VM is to move that into a container. And so I wonder if some of this will be stacks that get built and then they get put into production and they're left there until we have the next kind of generational shift of however that infrastructure is going to look.
Do you know what I said about like being worried about the engineering culture of those companies when we first started this? I mean, I get it, right? Like, it's a perfectly valid way to work. But I also don't think that that is the way that, in general, software engineering is moving. I think we're moving to a much faster-paced, shorter-lived model of application deployment than perhaps you would have done with an SAP or something that you would have put on a SCO Unix box somewhere. Like, I've dealt with those kinds of applications before, and they are anything but cutting edge.
Yeah. Cloud moves fast, like I said. I'm really hoping that a container from right now is going to be able to run the same way, the same image in 12 years. Because think about it, Kubernetes is a platform now. It's just like how VMware used to be, right? Or any kind of VM engine, right? We're past that. No more VMs. Now containers, at least for application development.
It's part of what always makes me slightly concerned about some of the serverless offerings from cloud providers, because you always make the point that, yes, I have my code, and that's the bit that's important to me as a business, and that's where my value is. But if I've built a bunch of integrations in my code with some proprietary message queuing system, for example, that I can't guarantee is going to be around in 12 years, and say I've got containers running in this long-lived 10-year-old Kubernetes cluster, but AWS decide they're going to kill SQS, for example, what happens then? It doesn't make any difference that my application is still on this nice, stable 10-year-old Kubernetes cluster because none of the components can talk to each other anymore. So I guess it goes back to what we were saying before about you have to be really, really conscious about what the application is and what the use case is. And it almost has to be self-contained on the level that everything is in this cluster and everything is something that you are willing to live with the technical debt of Kubernetes as it is today for the next 10, 12, whatever it is years. I mean, let's face it, if it's going to be 12 years, it's probably going to be 15 years because you're going to ride that thing right to the end and then go, oh, that's out of support now. And that's a 3-year project for someone to unpick the 12-year-old code, right?
Well, I think that brings us to the end. So before we close, thank you to our existing PayPal supporters and patrons. If you'd like to join those people, you can at hybridcloudshow.com/support, where for various amounts on Patreon, you can get an ad-free feed of either just this show or all the Late Night Linux family shows. And sometimes you get episodes early. If you have any questions or want to send us any feedback, please do to show@hybridcloudshow.com. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Until then, I've been Aaron.
I've been Gary.
I've been Sean.
And I've been Shane.
See you later.